It's the Law is Cool podcast, episode number 13. Hello, my name is Devin Johnston. I'm a second-year law student at the Robson Hall Faculty of Law in Winnipeg. And on today's show, I will be talking to a couple of political junkies about climate change and the upcoming federal election campaign. But first, Omar Haredi interviewed Caitlin Rose. Caitlin is a recent graduate of the McGill Faculty of Law, and during her time there, she helped to co-found an academic peer-reviewed health law journal. Let's listen to that interview.
Caitlin, it's Omar Haredi.
Hi, Omar. How are you?
Not bad. Do you have a few minutes to talk to me?
I do. Okay.
I'm interested more than anything else in the law review or the law journal that you've done because
okay.
I have a healthcare background and I'm very much interested in doing something like that at Western. But we can definitely talk about, you know, some of the other things you've done as well because working in the legal department at Cirque du Soleil is probably not something that every articling student...
That everybody does.
Yeah. So to start out, I'll just have you introduce yourself, say who you are. If you like, you can say where you're articling right now.
Okay. Well, my name's Caitlin Rose. I'm actually a summer student at Fasken Martineau, and I'm starting my articles in the fall this year.
Okay.
And I finished the Quebec Bar, and I did my studies at McGill. So there you go.
All right. And instead of starting right away, as I understand it, Caitlin, you had an interesting work experience, did you not?
I've worked in a couple of places since I started in law. I actually did a summer at Pfizer in-house.
Okay.
Pharmaceutical company, mm-hmm. and then started here at Fasken, and one of our clients is Cirque du Soleil, so I got sent there for a month to do a secondment, so that was something that not everybody gets to do, and I was actually employed through Fasken, but and representing, obviously, my office there.
Yeah.
And I was doing some work with the intellectual property department and working with employment contracts, general contracts, and basically any other legal issues that came up in the in-house department there.
Okay. And earlier today when I was at work, my boss actually forwarded me an email from Westlaw. And it was talking about the addition of a new journal that they're adding to their system, which is the McGill... Let me get the name right. The McGill
the name
Journal.
Has changed, so.
Yes, it has. Well, this
it
is the McGill Journal of Law and Health, and maybe you can
That's
explain
right.
to me why the name has changed.
The name has changed. This you'd actually want to ask Josh Wilner, who is the outgoing editor in chief. When I started, okay. it was called the McGill Health Law Publication,
mm-hmm.
Which was geared towards a more online community. Even though there were printed copies in the first developmental stages, it was always viewed as an online journal, which it still is, but
okay.
They wanted to get no misconceptions in terms of the fact that it actually was a journal.
Yeah.
It was an academic, peer-reviewed, blind peer-reviewed journal, and so they thought that the word journal would be more indicative of that fact than,
okay.
than the word publication, and that was kind of the shift that happened.
Okay.
So now it is the McGill Journal of Law and Health, and it
and
was
official.
Formerly the McGill Health Law Publication. So there you
okay.
go.
Okay. And what was your involvement with this publication?
Well, what started out, we had a McGill Health Law Club at the faculty. And
okay.
What happened was we started to toss around the idea of getting something official going. Obviously, the McGill Law Journal, the general McGill Law Journal is very well established and very reputable publication through the faculty.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a lot of support in the first year when we talked about the idea of kind of getting something out in the field of law and health, which is a very hot topic. And it is kind of in keeping with McGill's multidisciplinary approach. And so we started to talk about it, I guess, in 2005.
Okay.
And we got an advisory board together who were keen on the idea, and we went from there.
Okay. And where did you get support from, I guess, the faculty or from McGill itself in terms of funding?
The faculty itself was supportive, and actually the startup costs, I was more on the executive editor side as opposed to the management side, so I can't
okay.
tell you exactly how much everything cost, but we definitely had support from the dean, and so and then since they were kind of supportive of the initiative, and it was entirely student run, but we had kind of the backing, which made it a lot easier to get things off the ground.
Mm-hmm. And as an editor, how do you solicit submissions, and how do you get authors to contribute towards your journal?
Well, what we did originally, when I came into it, obviously I had an interest in the field, but I didn't have too much background. We were lucky with the executive that we had. We had relatively diverse interests, and the goal was to try not to limit ourselves to legal scholars.
Okay.
And so essentially what we did was we took our entire McGill Health Lab publication staff at the time, people that were interested. We'd kind of gone through the process and had interviews and had put together a team of people who had an interest in both domains.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of did a massive brainstorm of people we thought that might, you know, contribute to this journal in a way that would make for the kind of multidisciplinary bilingual contributions from various backgrounds, various domains, and we kind of narrowed it down by there within the executive to try to get a well-balanced perspective on different various health issues, policy issues, legal issues related to health and law.
And it looks like, I'm just looking over the issue here, and it seems like you have a submission from a professor of health law, but you also have an MPP, you have members of the Office of the Privacy Commissioner of Canada. So really a wide spread of different types of contributions here.
Yeah, and that was in part due to the students that were involved. Dan Ambrosini, who was co-editor-in-chief, was actually working with one of the contributors at the time, so that made things a little bit easier to solicit commentary from there. We also had Justice Beaudoin write the foreword on it, which was our introductory, which we thought was kind of apropos. The closing to it. It was a while ago, which was kind of apropos because, you know, a legal scholar, very involved in health law and also bilingual, which made for a nice tying together of all of the elements that we were looking for.
Definitely. Okay. And in terms of your publication schedule, looks like the first issue was in April 2007, and the next one is expected.
It's due any day now.
Okay. That's what I thought. Okay.
I called Josh a month or two ago, and we said we were going to have this meeting just to make sure that I was up to speed as to what to tell everybody on that one. Obviously, you know, publication dates, they're always have to be flexible given the amount of contributors and editing and the process, and sometimes things go back and forth, and given that it's peer-reviewed, sometimes, you know, pieces, they get an internal peer review within the editorial team, and they get sent out for a blind peer review, and then back, of course, to the authors, and so the process is hard to gauge exactly when the publication is going to come out.
Okay.
But now they're obviously in the very, very final stages, and actually the titles of the works are up on the site already.
Oh, they are? Okay, I'll have to check
that
out.
Yeah.
There isn't a fixed publication schedule, and I think that takes a little bit off the burden off of you guys as well as law students to try to keep a regular journal, in publication, right?
The goal, especially with the first publication, was obviously to get one out, but to get one out that was high quality. And so at the beginning, I think, if I remember correctly, our initial publication, our launch date, got pushed probably at least three times. But it was, you know, it was to take into account that we wanted this to be something of quality and that could continue over the years. And I have to say that getting the journal out in the first year, some certain things were sacrificed in order to get that publication out. For instance, setting up the backing and the framework to have a journal off the ground. And it was the team that came in after us that set up a lot of the things. Like, we had set a groundwork, and then they actually went in and went, okay, well, what is our policy on? And they sort of set out the criteria for solicitations and set out the criteria for, okay, we need some sort of guideline for how the editing is going to happen and all that sort of thing, because in the first publication, you're kind of winging it a lot of the time. Obviously, we had references and could see how the McGill Law Journal was doing things, and we had the advice of how things were happening, but we were calling a lot of the shots as they came through.
Okay.
And now it's starting to sort of gel a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And so hopefully from here on in, things should be on a pretty regular schedule. The goal is obviously one publication per year.
Okay.
at this point. But yeah, the rolling deadline is definitely something that is an advantage for law students, because what ends up happening is that oftentimes you receive a lot of the works from the contributors at a time when law students are, you know, going into exams or have papers due, or so obviously there is some flexibility that needs to happen there.
And
it
what
is
about,
extracurricular.
Yeah. And what about contributions from the students themselves? I mean, I'm sure law students are doing a lot of papers, and healthcare is a huge area of law now, and it's just growing. Is that something that you guys will consider as well?
We actually had a student contribution in the first publication by Kirsten Ali. It's, I'm trying to remember what the name of it is. They can check it out on the website. But that was actually a student contribution, and we made that decision in the first publication that we definitely wanted one piece.
Okay.
And what we did was we sent out, we kind of did a general call for submissions from students who had an interest, and then we had a couple of submissions, and we selected one that we thought was best in line.
Okay.
I'm not sure if the current publication has one, but it's definitely something that, you know, it was in our mind when we first started to have at least one student contribution, because, as you say, I mean, already over the past couple of years at McGill, the amount of health and law classes that have kind of sprouted up and seminars and things like that, it's definitely a hot topic. So.
Okay. Well, the reason why I'm interested in all of this is because at the University of Western Ontario, we really don't even have a law review or a law journal, let alone a health law journal. So it's something that I would love to see started here at Western, and I'm sure it's a lot of work as well. Is this something which students who are only interested in academia in terms of their future career should be interested in, or is it something broader? And how is, you know, law firms, when you're interviewing, how have they perceived it? Maybe you can shed some light on that as well.
Sure. I am definitely on the corporate law side of things. Health law is an interest of mine. It always has been, and some of the work that I'm doing now, obviously, that the background that I've had in that has been relevant. In terms of what I was doing at school, I didn't go into the publication thinking this is going to help me get a job, but it definitely came up in interviews. It can work to your advantage and it can work to your disadvantage. If you've got a resume that is entirely academic based, then they might start to ask questions in a big law firm environment as to, okay, well, do you want to teach? Do you want to do legal research? Or do you want to practice law? And you have to be prepared to answer that question. For me, I had a relatively diverse resume with a lot of different interests, and this was one of them. And it was a student initiative. We got to start something up. It was an area of law that I was interested in. It allowed me to use my legal skills and my writing skills in a way to sort of advance things in the faculty. It was a way of participating in student life. If you frame it sort of that way, then it definitely helps you out. I would say that it was viewed positively in interviews, but you do have to take that into account if you're looking for, let's say, a job in a big law firm, that if it's very academic based, your resume, then they might be asking the question. So I have to answer it.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for your time with us.
That was Omar Haredi of the University of Western Ontario interviewing Caitlin Rose, a summering student at Saskin-Martineau. Stephen Harper is expected to request the dissolution of Parliament tomorrow, and with a federal election campaign coming up, I decided to talk to a couple of political junkies about one of the issues that is expected to have a huge impact on the upcoming campaign.
It's Saturday, September the 6th, 2008, and the Prime Minister is expected to dissolve Parliament tomorrow, triggering a federal election. One of the issues that's expected to dominate the upcoming federal election campaign is climate change, and that is the topic of today's political chat. I'm talking today to Miranda Hussey. She is the author of the blog A View from the Left. She's also the president of the Oak Ridges Markham Young Liberals. Miranda, thanks for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
And also on the line today is Jim Johnston. He is a federal Green Party candidate of record in the riding of Lambton-Kent, Middlesex. How are you doing today?
Excellent, thank you.
Excellent. So we're going to talk about two issues today. First of all, the news that the Green Party has its first ever member of parliament. And also we're going to talk about climate change policy and how that might impact the upcoming election. So to get things started, Blair Wilson, who's the member of parliament for West Vancouver's Sunshine Coast Sea to Sky Country, announced last week that he will be joining the Green Party, becoming, therefore, the first Green Party MP ever. He's a former Liberal. He was removed from the Liberal caucus by Stéphane Dion over some funny business with his election financing from the last campaign. But I'll ask you, Jim, the Green Party has its first ever MP. It looks like he's not going to get a chance to sit in the House before this election gets called. But what does this mean for the Green Party? What does it mean for the political landscape in Canada? And how do you think this is going to play out in the upcoming election?
I think it's going to make a difference in terms of the legitimacy of the Green Party. The difficulty we've had in the past is getting acknowledgement for the amount of support we have across Canada, and this is one more piece of evidence that the Green Party voice should be heard and needs to be heard. I just want to also clarify one thing. You made reference to funny business and election financing. Elections Canada cleared Blair of all concerns except for a couple of minor infractions. He forgot to declare some umbrellas, and and he accepted a campaign donation before he had identified an official agent. But other than that, everything was cleared by Elections Canada.
Okay. And Miranda, you obviously are a member of the Liberal Party. Do you think that having a Green Party MP going into this election is something that's going to help the Liberals or hurt the Liberals, or will it have any effect at all?
I'm not sure that it'll necessarily help or hurt the Liberals. I do think it'd be a good idea to have the Greens in the debates. I've felt that for a while. I thought they should be in there in the last election because they do have a lot to add. I think in some ways it could help the Liberals because it does lead credence to the Liberals' Green Shift plan, but it also helps to have other ideas out there because no plan is perfect and no plan's ever going to satisfy everyone. So,
and on the topic of the Green Shift, so the Liberals announced this policy a few months ago, and it's very similar to a lot of the policies that the Green Party has been advancing, although it doesn't go to quite the same level. But the basic idea is a new tax on carbon, but that's offset by income tax cuts and other tax cuts. So how do you think this is going to play in the upcoming election? I've heard a lot of different opinions on this. Some people think this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. Others aren't so sure about it. What's your assessment of it?
I think it's a good plan. It's a comprehensive plan. I think it looks at a lot of different things. It ties into the plan for reducing poverty in Canada as well, in terms of some of the funding for that, which people had been asking, you know, well, where's that money going to come from? So I think in many ways it's comprehensive. Obviously, it's not a complete platform, and there will obviously be some changes made to it as consultations continue, because we even saw some earlier this week with the agriculture sector where the Liberals had been talking to them and come up with some agreements, which is why Stéphane Dion had built in that $1 billion space to sort of play with in terms of the moving a bit of funding around depending on what areas might need to have a little more compensation for the carbon tax.
And so just to disclose my biases, I'm a member of the New Democratic Party, and so I think a lot of people in my party have been looking at these Green Shift proposals and saying that they're not so much opposed to a carbon tax, but I think I've heard a lot of concerns from sort of the left that, you know, why do we need to have, you know, corporate and personal income tax cuts going along with this? And in particular, you know, assuming that the plan works and we gradually transition into becoming a carbon-free society, then what happens next? Do the income taxes go back to where they were pre-Green Shift, or do we run a deficit, or how's all that going to play out? And I'll throw that out to whoever wants to answer.
Well, I'll say that you know, requires a certain amount of speculation as to how the future is going to unfold.
Of course. Such is the nature of politics, I suppose.
It is. And I can't speak to what the liberals plan to do in that situation. But the general principle of tax shifting is to say whatever you have in society that you want to work, you subsidize, and what you have in society that is causing problems, you tax or limit. And in that case, it will be a long time before we have a perfect society, and it will be a question of constantly balancing that as time unfolds. I would say that it's very tempting, of course, to take a partisan point of view and say that to attack the liberal green shift. But I think the most important thing about it is that it has brought into the public eye the very important public policy considerations about what we do about greenhouse gases, because the Harper government has done virtually nothing about it. And in fact, if you look at the criticisms that the government is leveling against the liberal green shift, it is in fact raising arguments which diffuse and confuse the issue away from the public policy debate. The real question is, what kind of planet do we want to leave behind us in 50 years, and what do we have to do now to make that happen? And the conservative government under Stephen Harper still seems to not be too concerned about that, because they won't be in office then.
and on that note, I mean, there's been a lot of talk about climate change policy for the last couple of years, and it really looks like that's going to be one of the defining issues of the upcoming campaign. I wonder, can the Liberal Party or another party win a federal election with this green shift as one of their primary planks in their platform? Or is that going to be off-putting to a lot of voters, especially in provinces like Alberta or Saskatchewan, who, you know, are very dependent economically on things like the tar sands and oil extraction?
Well, I think if we keep getting stories like we heard earlier this week of ice shelves breaking up, and even with these severe hurricanes that we're now getting more and more frequently, I think as long as we keep having those stories, climate change is going to be in the minds of voters, and as we've even seen from the polling data, it's now one of the key issues, if not the key issue. So I think voters will be looking at the various parties' climate change plans, and it will be high up on the things that they are considering when they're choosing a party to vote for.
Interesting analysis. Well, This upcoming campaign is notable for a lot of reasons, but one of them, I think, will be the role that's played by technology and social media. I'm referring to Facebook and blogging and Twitter and other services like these. Would either of you care to comment on the role that you think that might play in the upcoming election? I know the Green Party has been very innovative in their use of online organization and to get their message out. What kind of a role do you think that might play?
Well, I think it's going to be quite important. Certainly the evidence from the U.S. Democratic primaries would suggest that their online presence made a big difference for Barack Obama. It is the way that people communicate now. And as an example, I found out that my daughter was engaged on Facebook. That is the kind of the way that our society is shifting and changing, and so we have to be adaptive to that. It's not only smart; it's important, because if politics is divorced from people, and people don't have an opportunity to input and influence the direction of politics, then our government spins out of control and goes off in a direction which is both unaccountable and not transparent, and that's what we want. In spite of what's been promised, of course, we haven't gotten that yet. And technology, I think, can play an important role in providing that.
And if I can just add quickly, I think it's very important to have the online presence of all the parties to engage the youth, because we keep hearing all these stories about, youth aren't involved in politics and they aren't interested in politics. But the youth are the ones who are really driving this online phenomena. So without an online presence of any of those parties, they're not going to be paying as much attention. And I think it helps get them involved in the process.
Yeah, you and I have both been involved in the youth wings of our respective parties, and there are two, I think, very interesting aspects about the engagement of youth in the upcoming election. First of all, it is true that youth tend to not show up to vote compared to other demographic brackets, but the interesting thing is we volunteer and get involved in campaigns more so than anybody else. And if you walk into a campaign office, you're likely to see a group of young people, very principled, hardworking people, really driving the campaign. The other interesting thing is that the Green Party, and we saw this in the last election, has been particularly effective at engaging youth and getting people who, you know, in previous years might have been non-voters actually out to the polls. And I think that's something, you know, very important in our political system and something that the Green Party should be commended for. Okay, so in light of the technology that the Green Party is using, in light of the environmental issues being at the forefront of this campaign, I'm going to put the million-dollar question, or perhaps the $2 million questions, out there. Can the Green Party retain its newfound seat in Vancouver, and or can Elizabeth May defeat Peter MacKay in Central Nova?
Well, I'll weigh in on that one. I've been very close to the campaign in Central Nova. And there is a large groundswell of support for Elizabeth there, and particularly because Peter MacKay was the person who sold the Progressive Conservatives down the river, and there are a lot of progressive elements who, within the Conservative Party, who still vote for him, but really would prefer not to. And after the Atlantic Accord and the turfing of Bill Casey from the Conservative Caucus, I think that there is a fairly strong anti-conservative sentiment throughout the province now. So I think that Elizabeth has a very good shot at upsetting Peter MacKay. I'm less familiar with Vancouver Sea to Sky, and so I really don't know what the dynamics are within that riding. So I won't comment on it. I know that Blair won the riding once, so I have every belief that he can win it again. But I guess you never know what's going to happen.
That's interesting. And of course, if Elizabeth May is invited to participate in the leaders' debates this year, that could be another element that will have a very significant impact, I think, on the Green Party's chances of electing members to Parliament. I see that we're closing in on 20 minutes, and I told you both that I would keep it pretty short today, but do either of you have some concluding thoughts about what we can expect from this upcoming election or anything else?
Well, I think it's going to be a very interesting election, actually, because we really have no sense of who's going to win at this point. It's very up in the air. No one has any idea, you know, what's going to be the defining issue of the election, whereas often in other elections, you know, you've sort of had a better idea than we have now. So I think it's going to be a really fascinating one to watch.
Excellent. And Jim, final word goes to you.
Wow. Well, I guess I'd have to agree with Miranda. I think it's going to be a very interesting election. I think it will be a moratorium on Stephen Harper's ability to lead, and whether or not he's gone past the point of leadership into bullyship, and whether that's going to sit well with Canadians. And so there are a number of key issues which are similar to the last election. We have the environment, we have the economy, which is now in bigger trouble than it was before. We now have a government that has a deficit rather than a surplus going in. And so the record of financial management isn't that good, and that's particularly difficult for a Conservative Party. So I think there could be lots of surprises ahead. And I do think that you'll see a lot more action from the Green Party this time around in a number of ridings. And I would agree with the sentiment that Elizabeth does need to be in the debates, because people need to see what the Green Party stands for, so that they can make an informed choice.
Excellent. Well, it's certainly going to be a very exciting and unpredictable campaign ahead. I know this will probably ruin my law school career as I'll be campaigning for the next month and a half. But thank you both so much for talking to me today. I've been on the line with Jim Johnston, a federal Green Party candidate in the last election for Lambton Kent Middlesex, and Miranda Hussey, who is a blogger from A View from the Left and the president of the Oak Ridges Markham Young Liberals. Thank you both so much for talking to me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.